so much of the challenge around treating weight is that folks who struggle with weight, and I would include myself in that, like up and down, I've struggled with my weight throughout my life. There is a stigma associated with it. I think sometimes society looks at you and says, just try a little harder, just eat less, exercise more. And this is a bit of a clunky analogy, but I'm fond of using it. Asking someone who struggles with obesity to diet and exercise is like asking someone with major depression to meditate. It's just not going to be sufficient if you don't address underlying biology.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Sarah Jones Zimmer brings a wealth of experience in shifting social norms to foster positive change. Drawing from this background, Sarah approached the complexities of diabetes with empathy, crafting an evidence-based weight care platform that harmonizes cutting-edge medicine with personalized coaching. Under Sarah's visionary leadership, the company has pioneered transformative initiatives within the weight loss community. By integrating personalized medicine and prescribed treatments from board-certified clinicians, they've harnessed the potent potential for sustainable change in the weight loss journey. In this episode, Sarah shines light on a new perspective on how personalized medicine can be the pathway to solving obesity during our lifetime. Here's our conversation. Welcome, Sarah. Thanks for joining today.
Thanks so much for having me, Christine.
It's great to connect with you, and it's really exciting what you're doing now. But before we start with what you do now, I think you have quite an interesting background, and I was looking at it. This is your first time dabbling into the healthcare, but before that, a lot of things you do is not really in healthcare. And what brought you here, and why, you know, what inspired you to join something in healthcare space?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I would say it's a long and winding road in many ways. But I'm sort of not surprised I ended up here. So I guess starting way at the beginning, growing up, my dad worked in pharma. So I did have a lot of exposure to healthcare through him, lots of healthcare professionals in my family, doctors, nurses, et cetera. So I think the seed was always there. But you're right. I started my career in investment management. I worked at a hedge fund. I later went into strategy consulting, and then I've spent a lot of my career in consumer internet. I was at an early stage e-commerce company. Then just prior to Found, I was at Bumble, the social networking and dating app focused on creating better experiences for women. But 3 years into that journey, I jokingly say that I became a professional patient. I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer in May of 2020. So right after the pandemic had shut the world down. I was 37 years old, no family history, had not even started getting mammograms yet. And so obviously a health crisis like that takes a pretty significant toll, and I think also shifts your perspective on a variety of things. And I was lucky that I could continue my work at Bumble while going through chemo and radiation and, gosh, 13 surgeries or something crazy like that. And shortly after Bumble IPO'd, which had been a primary focus of mine during that last stage of my career there, I was also declared cancer-free. And so I had this interesting moment to say, okay, what do I do next? Do I want to carve out a new P&L for myself at Bumble, or do I go back and build again? And I decided I wanted to build. You know, I had had this crazy cancer experience, which gives you a lot of perspective on what's important to you. And certainly so much of that for me was connecting with my children and my extended family and my partner. But a big piece of it also was, what am I going to do with my career? Mm-hmm. I really felt like I had this desire to build again. And I mean, candidly, initially, I was afraid to do anything in digital health. I remember talking to recruiters and saying, I'll do anything in consumer internet, social media, e-commerce, marketplace, maybe even fintech, just no digital health. I've been a professional patient. I've seen how broken it is. You know, on the one hand, I'd had great care at places like MD Anderson. And on the other, I had spent half a day on the phone trying to get prior auth for a scan I didn't even want. I'd seen the highs and the lows, and I wasn't sure it was for me. But coming out of something like Bumble, where you're bringing someone the relationship that could change the rest of their life, it was really hard to do anything that didn't feel like it had the same level of significance, the same level of potential for human impact. And if your barometer is potential for human impact, doesn't get much more impactful than health. And so I opened my mind to health. I started talking to a few interesting companies. And one of the things that caught my attention is that there had been so much innovation through digital health, through telehealth, but it was in all the downstream stuff. The diabetes, musculoskeletal, heart disease, even cancer and oncology. The root of so much of this was weight. And there had been no innovation in care delivery for weight, no real utilization of telehealth at scale to deliver better outcomes, to broaden access to care. And there'd been no innovation in the narrative. You know, we had had wonderful trends like body positivity and self-acceptance, and yet we were having skyrocketing rates of diabetes. So how might we thread the needle between those things and create better care delivery, better access to care, and simultaneously shift the conversation? And that's why I got excited about Bound and the role that this integrated, comprehensive, and personalized approach could play. The idea that we could give the clinician a seat at the table in the way that we think about weight loss and weight management, and that it was no longer just about willpower and eat less, exercise more. Mm-hmm. But it actually was about longitudinal care, chronic care management, treating obesity as a disease, not a decision, and actually creating the care model around that to really drive towards clinically significant better outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. I'm so glad that you are joining the healthcare, even though that was a tough decision, but I'm so happy to hear that you're cancer-free, because I can imagine how tough it is for you and a family. I have many friends who went through breast cancer and a survivor, and it's always tough during that time. And some still are struggling. And, you know, you always wonder when cancer is coming back. It's something that,
Yeah, I think living with that anxiety has been a new chapter for me to navigate. It's like the most wonderful thing when your oncologist says, I see no evidence of disease. Like, we all want to be NED, right? And then you do have these moments of fear when you wonder when it's going to come back. The scan anxiety every time I have to drive down to Houston, you know, to get my full workup every 3 to 6 months or so. Even this spring, I broke my sternum wakeboarding, which sounds like way cooler than it actually was. It was a really dumb mistake. And apparently something like 80% of bone metastasis is discovered through a break that shouldn't have happened. And it should be really hard to break your sternum, right? And we had a scare for a few weeks trying to navigate that and understand if it had spread. And, you know, we feel confident now after a series of scans that it's not. It's just a really bad broken sternum. But I actually think that like up and down journey with health gives me a different level of empathy for the patients that we serve, right? I don't think there's any chronic condition that any of us face that's like over fully, right? We're always still thinking about how we navigate that going forward. And so many of these things are comorbid with other things. I think health is a lifelong journey. And even things like chronic condition management, for me, the idea of taking medication for the rest of my life, if you'd asked me that at 20, I would have been like, that doesn't seem logical. And now there's certain meds that I will be on forever, and they're keeping my tumors at bay. And that's a wonderful outcome for me. And when I think about the patients that we serve at Found, most of them will need to take medication long-term to treat this in a chronic fashion. I think so much of it is about setting that expectation and helping to deliver care in a way for people that is still seamless and easy, even if it does mean taking medication long-term. And then making sure that you have the wrapper of the other things that you need, the behavior change, lifestyle change, the mental health support, the support of community to really carry you through that. And that's true for my journey and recovery from cancer. And it's true for so many of the members who seek care on Found.
Yeah, I think it's health is such a, you don't appreciate it until you've seen your close friends, circles, member, family members went through, you know, a health crisis, or if you go through it. But then I think once you have that, it's also can be a gift for you to kind of propel you to do amazing thing. And I think, you know, when you're
15 years old, you don't think about health. But when you experience, which is as bad as it is, it also can be a gift that you don't wish upon on anybody. But the fact that you have it, it can make a huge difference about your outlook about life and your priority, right?
There's like so much in there that we could unpack from your point about, you know, not realizing our own health until we have to sort of the gift that it is when you have that realization. In a way, I almost feel like it can become a superpower. I'm not saying that's the case for everyone, but I think it's made me so much more present. I feel like I like sit and watch my kids, you know, dancing around the fire pit, and I can hold the preciousness of that in such a different way than I once did. I really just try to be present. And I think it gives you an enhanced empathy for like all the stuff that life throws at us and all the stuff that people go through. You know, there's many forms of loss. There's many forms of joy. And yeah, there's something about the recognition of your own mortality that makes it really, I don't know, just precious when you think about this one life, this one body that we've got and how you may want to take care of it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's interesting you're saying, you know, for some it can be a blessing, or depending on which, make, you know, somebody mentioned that to me, that many of our listeners knows that I lost my husband, and I felt that it's a gift in a way, because I see how much it has propelled me doing a lot of good work. But I think it's also, it comes from a place where I felt supported. Not everybody have the own, not everybody have, you know, the luck to get a supported community. And I think, you know, sometimes that's why you said earlier, some people can see it as a blessing, as a gift, and some people are not. And I think it makes a difference on how you're supported. And I think, come to what you're saying earlier about, you know, obesity, managing your weight, I think oftentimes as a patient, or you don't feel as supported. Mm-hmm. Because there's always, it's like, oh, it's your fault. Maybe you didn't do X, Y, Z, da, da, da. And rather than think of it as a disease. So I'd like to hear more about what you try to do at Found and how is it different, how that is making an impact differently from any other program out there.
Yeah. I think you bring up a good point, which is like access to supportive community. And frankly, I think stigma is worth calling out here. So much of the challenge around treating weight is that folks who struggle with weight, and I would include myself in that, like up and down, I've struggled with my weight throughout my life. There is a stigma associated with it. I think sometimes society looks at you and says, just try a little harder, just eat less, exercise more. And this is a bit of a clunky analogy, but I'm fond of using it. Asking someone who struggles with obesity to diet and exercise is like asking someone with major depression to meditate. It's just not going to be sufficient if you don't address underlying biology. And, you know, I'm so proud of our society and how far we've come in our understanding of mental health and the supportive community that's necessary. Our understanding of obesity is 10 years behind that. And I really think we're starting to get to an inflection point where folks recognize that biology plays a central role. Whether it's genetics or hormones or uncontrolled cravings or broken signaling between your brain and your stomach, there are biological factors that no amount of willpower will solve. But some supportive medication, pharmacotherapy can unlock access to behavior change. If we can control the cravings in your brain through generic combination therapy, then maybe mindful eating becomes possible. Then maybe balancing your plate becomes possible. And so I think what we really strive to do is have a model that addresses biology, that leans into the science, evidence base, and that gives our patients tools to address biology. And often those tools are pharmacotherapy. We prescribe from a toolkit of 13 different medications and roughly 60 combination therapies. That's the foundation of our plan, being able to address that underlying biology. But then we wrap that in behavior change, things like movement and nutrition, and also sleep and stress management and recognition of social determinants of health, to create a really comprehensive plan for folks. And that does need to be a journey. It takes time. You know, weight loss needs to be done in a way that's sustainable for your lifestyle. And even some of the most innovative new medications, the GLP-1s, which we should talk about, still work best when they work in concert with lifestyle change. And they are designed for long-term use in the same way that a statin is, right? They are designed as a therapy that gets you to the desired outcome and then maintains it. Mm-hmm. And typically people will need to continue to take that pharmacotherapy to sustain that outcome. And so how do we make sure that all of the lifestyle changes, the routine utilization of medication, as well as the behavior change, are going to be sustainable for you? And that's how we've really thought about building and designing our program. And I do think that level of clinical excellence and that level of personalization are the factors that make Found unique in an increasingly competitive field.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the whole, the new GLP drug, GLP-1 drug is pretty amazing. I've talked to somebody who used it and I was like completely blown away about the impact. But you know, as anything, it costs a lot of money and there's some side effect. I think there's a lot of people, I think, start coming out in the news that they got stomach paralysis. That can be pretty scary, but you know, I can see why it can be very useful at the same time. And the other, you know, so with that is the, you know, there's a lot of therapy out there. And you were saying about lifestyle changes and I was just thinking there's so many other programs out there, like the Weight Watchers. That's kind of what they try to do. That is, they've been around. How is Found different from the Weight Watcher, the Noom out there?
Yeah, let me take the competitors question first, and then we can circle back to your first point. So historically, to simplify things, there was behavior change on one end of the spectrum, and there was bariatric surgery on the other. And there was really nothing in the middle, right? If you weren't a candidate for bariatric surgery or didn't want a surgical intervention like that, but you knew you needed more than behavior change, you could get on the wait list for an academic weight management center and hope for the best 9 to 12 months from now. What we're really trying to do is take that model that worked well in academic weight management centers and bring it to scale through technology, through a telehealth platform. Our chief medical officer is the former medical director of the American Board of Obesity Medicine and was a practicing obesity medicine specialist and endocrinologist at Cornell. And her wait list would be a year plus long. Now we're taking her philosophy, her strategy around treating obesity and weight, and using telehealth to give people across the country access to that level of integrated care. So she's developed an intake process for us that helps get at the root cause of obesity for each individual that comes through our platform. Is it brain hunger? Is it gut hunger? Is it emotional eating? Is it an inability to metabolize carbohydrates? We can distill your triggers as a result of asking a really detailed set of questions. Then we can come up with a treatment plan that's appropriate for you. So we're really taking that evidence-based, scientifically driven platform, and we're now bringing it to scale through telehealth. It's been interesting to watch folks like Weight Watchers and Noom move in the direction of adding medication. And I think that's a recognition, not that behavior change can't work for some. I think it does work for some, and they have evidence to show that. But for folks where there is a true biological driver as well, willpower is not going to be enough to overcome some of those challenges, and a more comprehensive solution is needed. I think ours, given our grounding in that academic weight management model, is really holding a high bar for clinical excellence. And that's the way we've decided to build our business. But I think there are many approaches for this. And look, unfortunately, 70% of Americans struggle with obesity and overweight. And so I would never speak ill of a competitor, because I think this is a large population health scale challenge, and we're going to need multiple approaches to solve it.
Mm-hmm. And you know, oftentimes when people join a program, it's always, you know, everybody joined the first year of the month. I mean, first month of the year, like January. I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. And then by, you know, 3 months, everybody just dropped off, or, you know, it wore off. How do you engage them and stay within the program? Because, you know, oftentimes you don't see result within 2 months, right? It's just everything takes, in order for them to stick, it has to be consistent
for That's a right. longer period of time.
It does take time to build those habits, including habits around taking medication. We definitely see a bit of a new year, new you phenomenon. For what it's worth, it's really interesting, actually. It's the same seasonality that the dating industry had. You know, like people come into January and they want to date by Valentine's Day. They want to put themselves out there and they have renewed willpower for resolution season. But our, you know, our chief medical officer has said that obesity is not seasonal. Weight challenges are not seasonal. And so while we do see some increased interest in the category in January, the challenges that exist and the need for comprehensive personalized care is year round. And that's what we seek to provide. I think a big piece of this, and you touched on it, is how do you create continued engagement? How do you really set people's minds that this is going to be a long-term change? And we want to build those habits bit by bit, including the utilization of medication, as opposed to having an expectation of losing 18 pounds in 3 weeks. And that's a big challenge, especially based on kind of our what ends up on the cover of People magazine, for example, and you know, people who are able to shed weight quickly. There are folks like that, but sustainable weight loss should happen over a period of time that includes both medication and lifestyle changes that are sustainable for you. And you touched on this earlier around kind of GLP-1s and the news that we're hearing. I want to emphasize these medications are amazing. They are creating life-changing results for folks, both the GLP-1s and the dual agonists like Eli Lilly's tirzepatide. They are driving amazing outcomes for folks because they are addressing things at a biological level that were challenging before. They are not silver bullets, and the pharma companies don't position them as such. I think they've done a good job of emphasizing that you may lose lean muscle mass. So what do? As a platform to support that, we introduce strength training. We add more protein to your diet. We need to really think about the interaction between these medications and how you're going to continue to live your life in order to maximize the impact that they can have while minimizing negative side effects. And that should be the case for any medication. I mean, you and I were talking about my cancer journey. And as I said, there's meds I'm going to be on for the rest of my life. It was a conversation between me and my oncologist that helped me understand that the juice is worth the squeeze in my case. I'm on some of these meds. They do have side effects. I experience nausea. I get achy joints. And yet they're keeping my tumors at bay. So that's a trade-off that I'm willing to engage in. That's the crux of how healthcare should be delivered, is shared decision-making. And so what we really try to think about is how do we get the clinician and the member, the patient, together to make a decision about their health? And so for those where a GLP-1 might be appropriate, it could be that it will stave off things like diabetes or reverse hypertension, and it's going to be worth the nausea and the side effects in order to get to that outcome. For others that are thinking about taking these medications recreationally to lose 10 pounds, I'm not sure that cost benefit is there. And that's why I would really encourage folks to make sure they are getting their prescription from a clinician who knows how to practice in this space. And there aren't that many obesity medicine practitioners in this country. There are a lot more prescriptions going out for GLP-1s. There's also a not insignificant percent of folks who are non-responders to GLP-1s. And maybe that's because the med isn't working on their underlying root cause of obesity, but some other combination might. So I would encourage folks to not get discouraged if they don't work and to seek out other resources, but to make sure that you're getting access to these things through a clinically sound and reputable channel.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
And I think one thing is, you know, also the behavior change, the biology, because I'm thinking about myself, you know, when I'm super stressed, I don't eat. And sometimes I'm super stressed, I eat nonstop. So it really, you know, depending on where I am in my stress, I think it started with no eating and then eating, and then it's like, oh my God, I cannot eat anymore. But I think there's also the fact that in, you know, society now, there's a lot more food abundance. Mm. And I remember, well, you know, American definitely is known for portion to be being very large and compared to different part of the world. But I think things are moving to that direction because, you know, who does not like to have more anything? And how is that, you know, at the same time, that is hard, is beyond the control of famine. And, you know, it's like, it's different as a society and it's a different food industry impact that, you know, restaurants wants to supersize everything for a different reason. And how is that, you know, being put into consideration in terms of changing the behavior, help people in your patient population to change that behavior, not to always go to supersize?
That is a great question. And that's a thread that we could pull for hours. I think you are right to recognize that a lot has changed in this country in terms of our food supply. We have abundance in some places and we have scarcity in others. And we have choices in some places and a lack of them in others. And there's a lot of processed food and there's a lot of additives. There's things that didn't exist 100 years ago. And so it's no wonder that that's having an influence on our diets. And as I said, I think that's a complex and thorny set of questions that require a public policy response on some level as well. I will say we're doing what we can to take action in places like that. We announced a partnership recently with Instacart in McAllen, Texas, which has the highest rate of adult obesity in this country per capita. We are partnering with the Food Bank of Rio Grande Valley, as well as Instacart and Unite Us to provide healthy meals via Instacart in an area that does have a lot of food deserts, where people are using convenience stores as their grocery stores and then are struggling to get access to things like whole fresh produce. So I think that there is a challenge on that level in terms of access. On the side of abundance, I will say that a lot of these medications will work to improve signaling between brain and stomach and will help you feel fullness or control portions, where, you know, some of the additives that are in our processed food are specifically designed to make you crave more of it. Mm-hmm. And we are trying to equip our members with the tools to be able to combat that. So we, in terms of the way that we provide nutrition guidance, we have no off-limits foods. We really believe that food does bring people a lot of joy, and that by trying to cut things completely out of your diet, you're more likely to fail. But we try to create tools, whether that's mindfulness or access to medication, that can make things like portion control easier. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think we have to think of this as an ecosystem. And sometimes I sit back and look around at our sedentary lifestyles, at our stress levels. Oh my gosh, the pandemic was a microcosm of this. And it's no wonder that so many Americans gained weight during the pandemic. It's all the things that are harmful to our bodies. Being sedentary, being cut off from friends, being stressed and wanting to... Yeah, exactly. Being stressed and wanting access to certain things. And I think you can look at that ecosystem and you can be discouraged and say there's no way to really solve this at scale. Or you can take one step at a time and think about the role that each of us can play in the ecosystem. And for us, the access to scaled telehealth to provide a wider toolkit of solutions that does incorporate medication so that we can unlock the ability to make informed choices. We can unlock the ability to move more freely. That is the small step that we can continue to take as an organization. And we're seeing that in our member base. We've served more than 215,000 people now, which makes us one of, if not the largest, medication-supported weight clinic in this country. And what's even more impactful to me than watching the number on the scale is watching what happens off the scale. At the non-scale victories we get, the everyday victories we get from our members, folks who can fit their wedding ring on for the first time in decades, or folks who can keep up with their kids on the playground, or another one we frequently hear is folks who loved travel, but they stopped because it was embarrassing to buy two seats or to ask for a seatbelt expander, and now they're back out doing the things that they love and seeing the world. That's why we do this work, right? To see those sorts of impacts in people's lives. And those are the victories that we want to celebrate. And actually, that's where the name of the company comes from, because we believe it's not about the weight you've lost. It's about the life you've found. Mm. And for many folks, being able to lose weight, being able to gain health, helps to unlock access to those life experiences that they deeply want.
Mm-hmm. And I think once they experience that, they probably have the incentive to keep on, like what you're saying about taking your medication for life, because that helps you to get certain joys that you would not have gotten otherwise.
That's right. There is something to momentum, right? You begin to experience those everyday victories for yourself, and that inspires you to keep going. And things like movement do get easier over time, and things like mindful nutrition do get easier over time, and medication can help. It's not a silver bullet. It's not a replacement, but it can be a really valuable tool that unlocks access to those other things and then gets you to that place where you're finding joy in your body in different ways than you were before.
So do you think your patient population, when they use BAM, what is the average time they are engaged with the program? Or is this something that they kind of tend to rely on for the rest of their life because it's nice and helpful? It's always good to have somebody who's rooting for you all the time.
Oh my gosh, yeah. To have a community in your corner, to have a coach in your corner. We do see folks that stay with us for years. The company has been serving patients since December of 2020, and we have some folks that have been with us that entire time. We really encourage members to commit to at least 6 months. We think that's the minimum that it takes to really develop those sustainable habits and to make sure we get you on the right medication combination therapy. I think it's also important to note that metabolic adaptation is real. The body fights back. I think anyone who has tried a quote-unquote diet has experienced this. Something will work for a certain amount of time, and then it will stop working because your body literally slows your metabolism down in order to try to get back to that set point weight. The most famous study of this was the Biggest Loser cohort, which actually tracked longitudinally over time the folks that participated in that TV show, The Biggest Loser. And it found that over time, their metabolism slowed so much that even eating the minimum amount of calories, 800 a day in some cases, they were still gaining weight. So that's part of the reason to continue to have a clinician in your corner. There are ways that we can keep the body guessing by changing your medication routine, by adding things to your diet, by adapting more generally. If your body's going to adapt, so does the program that's going to help you keep that weight off. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we really encourage folks to think about this as a lifelong change, to think about this as chronic condition management as opposed to some sort of quick fix.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that we do, you know, how amazing our body is, that we adapt to changes that come from the outside and then we make it work, and which also can hinder the progress that we want because it adapts to whatever exactly. That we don't want them to adapt to. But I know we can talk a lot about a lot of the work that you do at FAM, but I want to touch base a little bit on your experience running a company that's completely, you know, it's not completely different, but I think you do have a community, you try to make an impact. What you learn from running an organization like Bumble that you think that helped you run the FAM, and things that you completely taken you by surprise that, well, I've never seen anything quite like this.
Oh gosh, so many directions we could go with that one. So I was at Bumble for 4 years. I was chief operating officer for the first three and then chief strategy officer after I was diagnosed. I learned a ton. I joined that company when it was about 30 people, still operating out of a 2-bedroom apartment, and got to see it through to IPO. So certainly some really fundamental just leadership and how to run and scale an organization building blocks that I think were foundational to the way that I have thought about scaling FAM. I think some really interesting cultural pieces here as well. Bear with me, but you know, 10, 15 years ago, no one wanted to talk about meeting online. They would joke and say they met at the bar. Now 40% of Americans meet on a mobile app, and people write Bumble and Tinder and others into their wedding vows. There has just become a sea change in how culture has accepted these tools. I think part of it is that the tools themselves were exciting and engaging to use. And a big piece of it, especially in Bumble's case, was around brand and shifting the narrative, right? Bumble was never just about dating. It was about women. It was about accountability. It was about kindness. And that gave it an expansive platform to really shift the conversation around dating. I think we're in need of the same thing with weight. We need innovation in the care delivery model. We need engaging platforms that people want to use and will stick with over time. And we need to shape the conversation differently. As I said before, we need to thread the needle between things like body positivity and self-acceptance and better health outcomes. And I think the comprehensive approach that something like Found takes is the way that we do that. Biology is that thread. Recognizing that it's not a lack of willpower allows us to embrace self-acceptance and get to better health outcomes. So I think there's actually a lot of interesting parallels there. I do think things like supportive community matter. I think giving people a great experience so that when they leave your program, they tell three other people on their way out really matters. And that's true for dating, and that's true for weight as well. In terms of things that have really surprised me, I will say the complexity of regulation in healthcare has, what's the right set of words for this? It's taught me a lot. And I think what can sometimes be complex is a lack of clarity in certain places or overlapping jurisdictions. I'm very lucky that we have a wonderful general counsel and head of compliance who is decades deep in this world and has helped us to really navigate that in a high integrity way. I do think there's real room for policy to catch up with the vanguard of where we are right now. Amazing to think about the power of things like generative AI, for example, and even aggregated data that can help power inspiring new learnings. We've got to do that in a world where some of our HIPAA regulations were written during the time of fax machines. And so I am hopeful that we can continue to power this innovation on the front line of healthcare through technology, through things like machine learning and big data, powering incredible insights. And I'm very hopeful that that can operate hand in glove with advancements in policy and regulation.
I think it's, I feel like technology would unlock a lot of the challenges that we face in healthcare. I feel like I've been in the healthcare for many, many years. It's kind of fun to see the progress that
we accomplish.
And be it from the therapeutic side and even, you know, company like Found, who's helping people managing their condition. It's a lot of things that could not have happened. And it can happen now because technology has been developed for other, for a company like Bumble, for example, that probably has an easier regulation compared to the healthcare, but healthcare got to benefit from it. It's always on the, you know, we're all healthcare, I think, always behind for good reason. You know, we have to take care of people's health. I used to joke with the computer, you can shut it down, but with the human health, you cannot just, you know, tell the computer to shut down while you're in the middle of something.
No, agreed. And look, I recognize that it's a thorny set of issues. So I have a genetically linked cancer and have checked two. It's somewhat similar to BRCA, but gives you a higher propensity for breast cancer, prostate cancer in men, and colon cancer. And I wish that I had had access to a genetic test that could have told me that. Mm-hmm. The benefit is, like, my daughters both have it. And so they will get mammograms, they will get testing early and often. I wish I had had that choice. The technology existed, but the access to it for an everyday average consumer like me wasn't there.
Right.
And I know there are folks like 23andMe and others that are really innovating in this space. And I do hope that policy can catch up so that consumers will have more choice, because there's a lot that they can do with that information. Yeah. But I recognize the complexity of empowering people with their own health information and the downsides that could exist there. And I think it's issues like that that initially scared me away from wanting to work in digital health and in healthcare more broadly. But now it's stuff like that that inspires me to stay here, because I really feel like we're going to be able to solve obesity during our lifetime. We're going to be able to solve many forms of genetically linked cancer during our lifetime. But we need a policy and regulatory framework in which to operate so that we can drive towards those outcomes.
Yeah, I think I'm an optimist. And I feel like the, you know, sometimes when you read the media, everything is going wrong direction. But I think at the same time, when you look back 30 years ago and now, we have done so much. And so it's hard to say that we're getting worse, but I think certain things could be better. The certain things definitely is better. So last few questions before I let you go. I know you're on top of the hour here. What is the best advice that you got? And what is the worst advice that you've ever got?
Oh, gosh. It's always such a hard one to answer. You know, as cliche as this may sound, I think some of the best advice I got was from my dad. And I remember distinctly one piece of it was something along the lines of, if you find a job you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And that's not entirely true. Like, I definitely have had days where I'm like, I don't love this right now. And it does feel like work. But I am a big believer that like work can feel amazing. Partnering with colleagues can feel amazing. It can feel so fulfilling. There's a great Khalil Gibran quote that I also love that is, work is love made visible. And I think that's true. It's like our way of pouring out our passion for the world into work that we do that hopefully makes the world a better place. And so I don't 100% agree with my dad on that one, but I do feel like it's part of what has led me to many different chapters in my career and the curiosity to explore different things, because there is just so much world to know. And there are a lot of problems to solve, to your earlier point, but I have a lot of belief in humanity's ability to tackle those things. Worst advice I have ever received. You know, this is another funny one, and maybe I'm reflecting on this because my kids had their first day of school today. But I remember, you know, being in elementary school, middle school, high school, and being told that, like, you know, don't care what other people think. It doesn't matter what other people think. And I actually do care a lot about what other people think, not in a sort of self-degrading way. But I think if you care about the world, if you care about building a company, for example, I want to know what everybody on the team is thinking. I want to have regular touch points and cadences for getting their feedback. And I'm a big believer that great ideas come from everywhere. And so I do care about what people think. And I think it's short-sighted to block all of that stuff out.
Yeah, I think a lot of saying is always have it's hard to be absolute, right?
Love absolutely is not
absolute. You do have to care for the people that you care about what, you know, you care about what they think, versus if you don't care about that person, you tend to, you know, hopefully don't care so much. I think somebody was telling me before, my late mother-in-law told me, those who mind don't matter, and those who matter don't mind. I think that's the word.
I love that.
So I think, you know, it's, you know, depend on what situation you are in, right? That's why I always good to find out who gives you the feedback, because that makes a difference.
That's right. That's right. That's really well said.
Otherwise, anonymous is, you know, you don't know what data they have.
Right. And I think you can't empathize with their position or the context that they're asking from. So I agree. I really deeply value hard questions, and I love knowing where the questions are coming from so that I can understand how to best respond in ways that consider the context in which that person is asking.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, thank you so much for your time and sharing your story. I love that what you do, and it's great for you to make this transition to healthcare, and I think we all benefit from it.
Oh, thank you. I really deeply admire you and what you're building and the incredible stories that you've shared on this podcast. So it's an honor to be here. Thanks, Christine.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.